Time now on Radio 4 to join Simon Evans for another Jokonomics lecture.
Welcome to Simon Evans Goes to Market. Hello and welcome to Simon Evans Goes to Market, the show that is all about economics. Now, you'd be forgiven for thinking economics is dull. I mean, even Robert Peston seems to drift off in the middle of sentences and then wake up with a jolt towards the end. But even a cursory understanding of economics can help you see how the world works and could change your life. Markets are the most natural, unmediated expression of human nature there is. They're not always a pretty sight, characterised as they are by greed, cunning and badly placed apostrophes. But if you understand them, you're halfway to understanding what's really going on in the world. And besides, I actually put an apostrophe into apostrophes then, and this is Radio 4. I grew up in St Albans, which is technically a cathedral city, but much more importantly, a market town. I mean, yes, a cathedral can save your soul, but a market can save you pounds on your weekly shop. On non-market days, the high street in St Albans was like a luge in summertime, just a bare concrete thoroughfare where you could still get your nose broken if you weren't careful. But on Wednesdays and Saturdays, it awoke, as if from a coma. To this day, whenever I'm supposed to be away relaxing in the country, it's only when I get to the local market that my shoulders really drop. Market taverns are the best taverns, market squares are the best squares, and Market Harbour is the best harbour. And if I feel that kind of enthusiasm for markets, and I'm just a comedian, imagine how enthusiastic my co-host for this show must be. He's a Financial Times economist and presenter of Radio 4's More or Less. Please welcome the Sultan of Stats, Tim Harford. Tim, I would like to picture you as a young lad being led through market stalls by your mother and eagerly telling her that, look, mother, there is an oversupply of tomatoes and the price is falling accordingly. Was that where you first got the gist of how it works?
Actually, my mother used to take me to the supermarket. And I think in some ways, sad though it is, the supermarket might be a better microcosm of the modern world than the fruit and veg market, because rather than seeing supply and demand work in front of your eyes, you're participating in this sort of artificial game. The big corporation sets the rules. Okay, you can go and shop elsewhere, but within that space, you're being manipulated, you're being watched, you're being spied upon, you're being offered choices that aren't really choices. And welcome to the 21st century.
I was going to say, wow, but actually I can easily imagine you as a seven-year-old explaining all of that to your mother. And mother, you're being manipulated, children at sea. Well, listen, in this series, we're not going to look at fruit and veg, but at some rather more addictive goods, namely alcohol, tobacco, sugar, and in this episode, coffee. But of course, as you all know, coffee is up in a cup, whether it be a single-shot tweaker in a beaker or a half-pint thug in a mug. It fuels Homo digitalis as surely as oil fuels his machines. It's fast-challenging tea as this nation's favourite currently legal high. Sales of instant are up while sales of tea are down, and 85% of Britons visit a coffee shop at least once a week, many of them appearing to stay in there for very nearly that long as well. One in five people go to a coffee shop every single day, and they can't all just be using the loo. The cafe latte is now the nation's favourite drink, and popular though it is, we still lag well behind other European nations. The Germans drink roughly three times what we do, and the Finnish five times, which is presumably while they're finished. It's not just coffee shops either. Wetherspoon sells a million coffees a week now, even when it isn't in a special deal with a curry. Meanwhile, we're experiencing the blossoming of a trendy new coffee shop phenomenon catering to bearded artisanal coffee snobs and their sophisticated Scandinavian boyfriends in what is being described as the third wave of coffee. Clearly, serving coffee can harness helplessly habitual human hacktivity to make a profit, but what I'd like to know is, are there deeper economic implications for this new coffee craze? Now, in order to bring the process to life, we've secured a human guinea pig for the series, so please welcome Andy!
Yeah,
Incredibly, Andy here has no bad habits whatsoever and therefore has developed no tolerance to any of the substances we're investigating. He's like a real-life Inca or Aztec or Catholic. He's also one of the writers on this show, which is why I thought it would be hilarious to try and sabotage him with strong psychoactive chemicals. It's a bit like that experiment when NASA gave spiders different drugs to see what it would do to their webs. I don't know if you remember this, it was a few years ago now, but the spiders on LSD made terrific ornate webs with very interesting patterns. Spiders on ecstasy made strangely repetitive webs. And those on cannabis didn't actually bother making webs, they just went to get some flies from an all-night garage. The spiders on caffeine, however, and this bit is true, made the worst, most incoherent webs of all. And that, Andy, is what we're going to do to you. It is also, I should warn you, fiendishly addictive, though in my experience, giving it up is easy enough as long as you have 3 clear days without deadlines and no need to interact with other members of humanity. Especially not your own children. Do you have children?
I do not.
Okay, you're probably all right. And you've never tried coffee before?
I've never had a coffee. I've never let it past my lips. I quite like tiramisu.
Well, I think that we can count that as a no. Can I just ask, sorry, something is puzzling me. If you've never had coffee and you are a young person, relatively speaking, what is it when you've been on a date? What do you go in for when you actually want to have sex?
I'm a comedy writer, so that doesn't really come up.
Okay, fine, all right. Well, you can take this one back with you. This is a thick, flat white, apparently, the closest thing to a tiramisu in a cup.
Can you draw something in the top? I've seen when you go to a coffee shop, people draw things in the top.
Oh, OK, hang on. You. OK. You neck that. We'll leave you there. You've got your notepad, you've got your pencil. Let's see if you can turn your life around, or at least keep your job. Now... A new book out entitled The Flat White Economy suggests that independent third wave coffee shops are the visible tip of a whole new digital economy iceberg whose importance is easily missed and greatly underestimated. There is more here going on than coffee, Tim, this whole new economy.
There is a really interesting point that gets made, so for example by the writer Stephen Johnson, which is that the coffee shop itself, it's not just the caffeine, but the ambience of the coffee shop is a hub of innovation. People are talking to each other, they're swapping ideas, they're talking very fast, of course, they're very excited. And so ideas spread. There's the phrase, ideas have sex with each other and beget new ideas in a coffee shop. So my favourite example, 1957, Sputnik is launched. A few physicists in Maryland in the United States start talking about Sputnik, and then they invent the idea of global positioning satellites. Where did it come from? Where were they having that conversation? In a coffee shop.
I don't know if you are aware of the Hungarian maths genius Paul Erdős, who used to say that a mathematician was a machine for turning coffee into theorems, although he used to spice it up a bit with Benzedrine as well, I believe. But... He really was ahead of his time. If you look at the new economy really amounts to now, virtually every new profession of the last 30 years, software engineers, web designers, app developers, they're just machines for turning coffee into marketable commodities. And it really does seem to me this little insidious black liquid from the souks of Arabia is the one ancient analog ingredient without which the high-tech world cannot function. It's an odd balance. But listen, what about the plant itself? Incredibly, given the range of options available in stores today, you may be surprised to learn there are actually only 2 basic plants that all the world's coffee comes from. They're called Arabica and Robusta. Now, Robusta, or Robusta, is the less complex flavour-wise and has something of a bitter aftertaste, but it grows anywhere and has a kick like a mule. Arabica, on the other hand, is subtle and entrancing in the mouth, but temperamental in the soil. I like to imagine them as 2 characters in an old Jilly Cooper book about a girl's boarding school. Robusta is the one with the thickish ankles and the can-do attitude. Arabica, tiny feet, fluttering lashes. Sorry to be a nuisance, but she simply has to sleep precisely 11 feet from the window. Would you be ever so sweet and bring me the lavender oil from my valise? Margaret Rutherford and Audrey Hepburn, if you will, or you can update references to taste. But Vietnam, now second only to Brazil as a producer of coffee, grows Robusta in abundance. And while their trophy shelf may remain bare, they are also rarely visited by earnest small-batch roasters from Hoxton. So, swings and roundabouts. Arabica, on the other hand, is the business class brew, and it can get furiously expensive, right up to the Kopi Luwak or civet coffee, which is famously passed through the digestive tract of a mongoose before being roasted. Now, there really is a machine for turning coffee into shit. Very fine and dainty. Robusta, on the other hand, gets on with the task of waking up the nation's nurses and cab drivers every morning and never gets so much as an Instagram of thanks. So it goes. Despite there being only these two plants which supply all the world's coffee, there are now a myriad, a dazzling variety of what are known as varietals, which now exist and which are used to inspire debate among connoisseurs. I wanted to find out a little bit more about this, so I went to the London Coffee Festival. I spoke to Oni Loy and Michael Cleland, two purveyors of speciality coffee from Assembly Coffee, about where all these miraculous tastes come from.
This is based on the idea that coffees possess unique characteristics, not unlike the way that wines do, because of the impact of their provenance and the variety of the coffee itself and the way it's been processed.
And seriously, how many British customers do you think are capable of distinguishing between different coffees to that extent? I mean, even between Arabica and Robusta derivations.
This is a very exciting time. Specialty coffee in London has been a growth market now for 5-7 years, and it is exponentially exploding, as we can see in the cafe culture that's developing, and everyone's opening cafes and coming to understand a lot more about the product that they're working with. In terms of the consumer, I think today, compared to 5 years ago, people are now becoming more familiar with origin as a whole in terms of the kind of coffees that they like, be it those deep, full-bodied chocolate caramel profiles, which typically would be found in South Central America, or the more developed, more discerning coffee drinker, they potentially would enjoy the brighter, more floral notes, and they are coming to understand today that those coffees are grown in Africa.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? Only 40 years ago, Monty Python could get big laughs by mocking the Australian wine industry, and now we can hear an Australian talking about coffee having floral notes. Things are getting out of hand. However, I listened patiently, at least I looked that way, as I heard Oni tell me how he buys his floral note coffee direct from farmers.
It was by no means a commercial decision. We took out all of the middlemen. We stopped buying from cooperatives in the same area and built relationships with 17 farmers in Peru. It cost us a higher price, but we're safe in the knowledge that those farmers are receiving the majority of that purchase.
Now, this is interesting, Tim, because for a while we were all led to believe that fair trade was the last word in creating a level playing ground, but now it sounds that perhaps direct trade rather than fair trade. I don't know. Do you have any views on these mechanisms?
What many people want to do is to really to tip the person who grew the coffee for them. So you can tip the person who serves the coffee, but you can't tip the person who's working so hard to actually produce the bean. But how are you going to do that? You don't know who they are. They're on the other side of the world. So how do you send money that you're willing to donate, you feel has been hard-earned? And so that's where the whole fair trade movement came in. So fair trade is basically sending an inspector around the world to check that these people are actually being properly paid and they are working in good conditions. And so then you can put the label on the coffee. And the trouble is, it's actually pretty expensive to send inspectors around the world looking at coffee farms. So if you apply for fair trade certification, for example, that's 400 quid, then the first audit, that's 1,000 quid. It's actually very expensive.
Beginning
for the
to sound a lot like FIFA, to be honest.
I wouldn't go quite that far, but it's certainly, there have been some economists who've done research on this, and they say, well, fair trade, it might be effective, it might be doing some good, but we can't be sure. And I think you've got to come to the same conclusion with direct trade. It sounds great, but all this stuff is very expensive. It's not easy to lift people out of poverty just using coffee.
Mm. And meanwhile, of course, we shouldn't be too dismissive of Robusta, because instant coffee is still massively big.
We should be dismissive of Robusta. Well, we should be dismissive of instant coffee. It's
disgusting
stuff. I'm a grown-up.
I don't like it either. I agree. It's a mockery. It survives the granulation process about as well as a lamb chop would do.
But you see, you and I, Simon, we are sophisticated
people. Yeah.
But it turns out we're in a minority. So even in America, where you thought they are fond of drinking horrible processed drinks, instant coffee is only 7% of the coffee market. Here in the UK, 77%.
That is actually disgusting to me, because I have been doing some reading on this, and it turns out Americans are responsible for us drinking instant coffee. We'd never heard of the stuff until American GIs came here during the war, brought this with them as a sort of stopgap so that they could get coffee while they're over here, and we lap this stuff up. It's a very British mentality, though. Quite good enough for us, thank you very much. Just have the powdered instant, thank you. And meanwhile, as you say, the Americans have gone off, and the Italians, I believe, drink 1% of instant coffee, which...
I can't believe it's as much as 1%.
No.
I mean, it's like, if you were to serve Kenko or something to an Italian, that would be like a declaration of war. That would
be... I think what happens in this country is that many of us give up drinking instant coffee with rising disposable income, but then we often reintroduce ourselves to it as we discover the imperatives of the state pension. And... indeed, the declining ability of our aging taste buds to tell the difference anyway, which is one of those happy coincidences. But something big did happen not that long ago. It seems now it's like many things, like smartphones and digital cameras. The espresso revolution was only about 15 years ago. I remember in the late 1990s, espresso was only made in stovetop machines owned by self-unemployed communists who had managed to buy the rent book of a Clerkenwell council flat from a single mum they'd been briefly shacked up with and were now using it as a base for organising the revolution and selling knockoff Athena posters. That was where you would encounter espresso. Suddenly, it's become the cornerstone for any number of indulgent treats. And there's this growing sense that it's the only viable way to operate commercial premises at street level in much of urban Britain. I have to declare a bias at this point as far as coffee goes. I live in Brighton, Brighton and Hove. Brighton is coffee ground zero, which is actually a slightly cleverer thing to say than you've probably realised. And... coffee in Brighton is now, it's like Nokia was in the 90s. There are more coffee shops than people. We have the highest coffee consumption per capita in the UK, £177 per person per year, which is apparently £25 a head more than in London. It has become the lifeblood of the city, more so even than heroin and hen parties. It's extraordinary. Everywhere in Brighton now serves coffee, art galleries, barbershops, colonic irrigators, everywhere. And on the other hand, coffee shops now have expanded their offer to include live music and bicycle maintenance and yoga. And there's this seesaw. One of them are saying, why go to a coffee shop when you can have great coffee in an art gallery? Why go to an art gallery when you can see great art in our coffee shop? Why go to a tattoo parlour when someone in this record shop is so wired on coffee they'll have a go on you for free? And so we have reached... saturation, you would think, but I don't know. It just seems to spiral out of control. I want to know, is there any kind of precedent? The only thing I can think of was Douglas Adams' shoe event horizon in the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where more and more shoe shops overwhelmed the high street and eventually the whole economy just collapsed. That's the only other example of this I've ever encountered.
If you go back to The Onion in the late 90s, they were already joking back then. They had an article that Starbucks was opening a cafe inside the toilet of another Starbucks. So you could get a latte while you were queuing to use the loo. But back then, there were 2,000 Starbucks. There are now 21,000 Starbucks. So there's 10 times as many Starbucks in America as there were. So it's weird. You've got to think that there must be some point at which this becomes completely unsustainable, but we keep going.
Is there some hidden dynamic where the more coffee shops there are, the more people will respond to them?
This is economics, so there's always a hidden dynamic. But it's a bit like when you go into the supermarket and you see, oh, you know, there are the Cheerios and the cinnamon Cheerios and the apple cinnamon Cheerios and the protein cinnamon Cheerios and the nut-free. And you realise the whole aisle is packed with all of these different varieties of Cheerios. And somebody who wants to launch a breakfast cereal, they can't do it because every possible niche is already filled. So the idea is it's the same with coffee shops. If Starbucks tries to scare away competitors or Costa try to scare away competitors by lowering the price, well, people know the price could always go up again tomorrow. But if they try to scare away competitors by opening 5 coffee shops on one street, that is a credible threat. Nobody is going to go toe-to-toe against that. So it's an attempt to pack the market and make it impossible for competitors to get in there. But obviously, Brighton hasn't yet got the message.
I've got to say, I'm as sceptical about the whole Chocomoccacino thing as the next balding 50-something, but that's really not the point anymore. The espresso revolution has actually changed more than just the way we drink coffee. It has changed the way we use the high street. The coffee shop now is clearly it's a hub. It's not just the coffee, it's not just the crying toddlers or the stylish black and white photos of geriatric Italian sex pests. It's the free Wi-Fi and the power sockets and the ambient creativity and the exchange of ideas, as you say. And most of all, it's a place where you might actually become one of your more cherished notions of yourself. And although they're selling an ancient brew, coffee shops, I think, are best understood economically alongside digital giants like Apple and Amazon and Google. In some cases, they even follow their tax strategies. I can never remember... I can never remember which one is avoiding and which one is evading. So let's just say Starbucks have been accused of shimmying past what what might strike some as their fiscal obligations.
As the economist, I should say that it's perfectly legitimate what they're doing. I mean, I'm all in favour of us getting taxes from big American multinationals. That sounds like a great idea, but we've got to bear in mind that they pay taxes on the income that they pay their staff, they pay taxes on the premises, they pay VAT on the stuff that they sell. So, sure, it'd be nice to collect some profit tax as well, but if we have structured our tax system so as to make it entirely optional, we can't really blame them if they take the option.
And enough small businesses are being run out of Starbucks on a daily basis without them paying any overheads either, so I suppose that's fair enough. What are the economics of running a coffee shop?
You're always trying as a coffee shop owner to persuade the idiots who are willing to pay more to actually pay more. So you need to find something. So, OK, well, we'll offer the marshmallows. They cost like 3p, but we'll charge you an extra 50p for marshmallows. You want a little kind of squirt of that horrible, mucky cream, that's another 50p. And, you know, certain people will come up and they will pay for the marshmallows, they'll pay for the cream, they keep paying. So that's the price discrimination.
One thing I want to know, have you, let's say a latte is about £2.50 now, how much of that is actually going on coffee?
On the coffee beans, it's about 10 pence. You're probably paying more for the paper cup.
However, the relatively small portion of the price of your coffee that goes on the beans is actually very good news for coffee producers because it encourages them to focus on quality. If you think about it, if a sack of good coffee is $200, but a sack of okay coffee is just $100, well, then it sounds like a tempting bargain to get the cheap stuff. But if that price difference equates to just an extra 5 pence a cup for really good coffee, then suddenly the cheap stuff doesn't look so tempting because your customers won't come back, which means the high overall cost of your morning latte is in fact the surest way to make sure farmers are encouraged to follow best practices and produce the best beans. Consequently, the equation for the new artisanal coffee shops is not do we or don't we offer ethically sourced superior blends, but rather just how ethically sourced and superior can we go? It's time to see how our guinea pig is doing. Andy, you've had a couple of shots of the hard stuff, albeit in a deep, milky, drowned beverage. How are you feeling?
I feel quite alert. I feel quite sweaty. I'm very aware of my heart.
Well, you finished your latte. We've got a couple of espresso shots in here. This is a slightly more grown-up variant. Apparently, this one comes with a caramel and chocolate syrup in, however, although to you it'll probably still taste like you've licked a rusty hinge. There you go.
Thanks.
You get that down your neck. Now, also to go with your order, there's flapjack there, a cookie the size of a child's face, one of those caramel discs you're supposed to put on top of the cup, a branded mug, a piece of local art that was hanging on the wall of the coffee shop, and a choice of an easy-listening Bossa Nova CD or the latest one by Paul McCartney. So, that's the full experience for you right there.
Great.
And that'll be £240, please. But don't worry, you also get a stamp on your loyalty card. Only another 9 stamps and you'll have lost the card. So, we've demonstrated that coffee shops are big business and are likely to be here to stay. And we've also demonstrated, I think, that they are a fairly ethical economic phenomenon. But is there money that we can make as private investors? I spoke to Merin Somerset Webb, the editor of Money Week, and asked her, how do we invest? Should we be gambling, perhaps, on the price of coffee as a commodity?
Investing in the price directly is, I think, way too risky for ordinary investors, for the likes of us. But you could buy yourself a small coffee plantation. I saw a lovely little one in Costa Rica. It's only 9 acres, but it's got a gorgeous house with it, $645,000.
Do they tell you how much you can hope to earn from that?
Well, it tells you how much coffee you can make, but of course it depends on whether you actually do that and the price you sell it at. I suspect that you're probably a lot better off using these little plantations for agritourism, which is very popular in Costa Rica, so you have a small farm attached attached to a house in which you do B&B or a small hotel or something like that. But Costa Rica is beautiful. And if I was looking for a holiday house which happened to be attached to a coffee plantation, I think it would be on my list.
So there you have it. The answer, as so often in life, is to move to Costa Rica. But what if you don't want to move to Costa Rica? Maybe you'd miss spring watch, or indeed spring, or giving a fifth of your wages to a railway company.
The other way to invest in coffee in the UK is actually coffee shops. The GDP numbers that we had out last showed that the economy is currently basically being driven by coffee shops, by people going out to eat and going out to drink coffee. And I think that is something that really will continue.
How would you invest in those? The big chains, or?
The big chains, absolutely fine. When Wetherspoons has reported excellent results. And then you can invest in small coffee shops as well. Again, if you go onto the crowdfunding websites, you will find loads and loads and loads of small coffee shops looking for funding and financing. The small ones, can they last next to the big ones? Who can know? But it's kind of a fun investment.
So there you have it. Try crowdfunding and give your life savings to some hipsters so they can buy an old tandem to hang on the wall next to the espresso machine. But is the government missing a trick here? Coffee is an addictive substance, or at least it's highly habit-forming. Is there a reason they haven't sought to extract more revenue from the coffee boom?
There's not a good reason to tax coffee in particular, in that it's not bad for you. It doesn't do anything wrong. It's not cigarettes. It's not alcohol. People going out and drinking coffee together is a really good thing, something to be encouraged by our tax system, not discouraged by it.
She is right, of course. Coffee is a good thing. Now, let's see if our guinea pig Andy agrees. Andy, how has the espresso gone down?
Oh, it's brilliant. I feel so productive. I mean, in the last 10 minutes alone, I've mentally reorganised my bookshelves at home. I've done my tax return. I've worked out who stole Shergar. I've watched 18 TED Talks. I've sketched out the plot to a five-part novel series. And I've worked out what Labour needs to do to win back the electorate. It's amazing.
You shouldn't have any trouble sleeping next weekend. So, what have we learned? Italians don't drink instant coffee, preferring to take hours out of their working day to grind their own beans. Ah, another piece of the puzzle that is the Eurozone crisis falls into place. Some of history's greatest ideas have been born in the coffee shop, making it even more surprising that no one in there has had the bright idea to clean the bloody toilets once in a while. If you've got 600,000 spare, you can buy a 9-acre coffee plantation in Costa Rica. Or for the same money, you can buy a bedsit in London and try and grow something in a window box. Coffee shops spend more on paper cups than they do on ingredients. So you think they'd be happier when I go in and glug it straight from the nozzle. But no. But mainly, the economics of coffee are good. Coffee is addictive, but it is benevolent. It's a great way to support your local high street, local culture, and make the world better for really hard-working families. Those in Colombia, Costa Rica, and Brazil. Bring a bit of South American zing to your life. Addiction is only bad if you need to give it up. And God willing, you never will. Thank you very much for listening. I've been Simon Evans. Thank you, and good night. To Simon Evans Goes to Market, where I was joined by Tim Harford, Oni Loisel, Michael Cleland, and Merrin Somerset Webb. It was written by me, Simon Evans, with Benjamin Partridge, Andy Walton, and Guy Venables. And the producer was Claire Jones. It was a BBC Radio comedy production.